Join me, Dr. Panico, with Cindy Lauper and Chef Michelle Bernstein to talk about plaque psoriasis and psoriatic arthritis, the potential connection and risk of developing permanent joint damage.
Cosentyx secukinumab is prescribed for adults with moderate to severe plaque psoriasis 300 milligram dose and adults with active psoriatic arthritis 150 milligram dose. Don't use if you're allergic to Cosentyx. Before starting, get checked for tuberculosis. An increased risk of infections and lowered ability to fight them may occur, like tuberculosis or other serious bacterial, fungal, or viral infections. Some are fatal. Tell your doctor if you have an infection or symptoms like fevers, sweats, chills, muscle aches, or cough, had a vaccine or plan to, or if inflammatory bowel disease symptoms develop or worsen. Serious allergic reactions and severe eczema-like skin reactions may occur.
Learn more at 1-844-COSENTYX or cosentyx.com/Cindy.
Last year, Americans ate 32 billion chicken wings. Who knows just how many helpless sides of celery were heartlessly thrown away? But this year, celery neglect can stop with you and irresistible Jif peanut butter. Because you can make a snack to make a difference. You can buy a jar of Jif to save the celery. So please, don't let celery be decoration for wings. Tap the banner to save the celery.
Future Proof Extra
with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland
on News Talk.
Now, a lot that we learn from space is from looking out the window or staring up at the stars. But we can also learn quite a bit about the history of our solar system through things that land on our surface. Joshua Haujigo is author of The Meteorite Hunters. He joins me now. Welcome to the program, Josh. This is a subject we haven't spent a lot of time speaking about, and I think it's really, really interesting. So let's start off with the age-old thing of just defining each of the terms, if you don't mind, because every year I remind myself what each one is. So what's a meteorite and what's the other one?
Well, firstly, thank you for having me on. And yeah, it can be a bit confusing. So a meteor, technically speaking, is when one of these rocks, for want of a better word, is still kind of shooting through the atmosphere. So that's a meteor, or you could call it a shooting star. When it hits the ground, we call it a meteorite. And people don't really use this term very much, but when it's still in space, you could call it a meteoroid, or if it's very big, then you would call it an asteroid. So that's the terminology. Yeah.
Right. And if it's made of ice, it's a comet.
Well, yes, although one of the things that came up in my book is that there is kind of a bit of a loose distinction between meteorites and comets. We tend to think of comets as being these icy things, but they're kind of a continuum. It's more of a continuum than you might think. But yes, that is correct, yeah.
Okay, so where do these rocks come from? And how come we don't have lots more of them? I have so many questions, I just realized. So let's start off with where do they come from?
Where do they come from? So they mostly come from the asteroid belt. So we're talking about beyond Mars and before Jupiter. There is this kind of jostling mass of asteroids out there. Now, people who've watched things like some of the Star Wars movies, you might think of sort of, a lot of material jostling together. Don't have that picture in your mind.
The asteroid belt that they sort of navigate through and they have to do these really tight corners and go up and down. They're so far apart that would never happen. Is that right?
That's it. So they're quite far apart. But that's originally where meteorites come from. And there is this kind of complicated mechanism to do with the gravity of Jupiter, which basically jostles them around and in certain parts in that asteroid belt, and they will get their orbits disrupted and then they will end up crossing Earth's orbit. So that's how we kind of get meteorites coming down to join us on Earth.
Right. So this is debris that came from almost as far back as the formation of the planets. It's sort of spinning around, and every once in a while, because of its ellipse, it gets pulled closer to a large planet like Jupiter and nudged just slightly, and then it ends up going in a different direction than how it has been for the last billions of years. and ends up in the path of Earth. Is that essentially it?
That's more or less it. So the one way to think about it is like the asteroids in the asteroid belt are all orbiting, and so is Jupiter. And so if you think about them as a little bit like hands on a clock, right? So occasionally these orbits of the asteroids and Jupiter will line up. And when that happens, they get a little bit of a gravitational tug. And this only happens depending on particular kind of resonances of orbits. So it's not all asteroids, it's just sort of some particular places. But it's that gravitational mechanism which disrupts the orbits, and it can cause collisions. And it's that eventually, over like thousands and thousands of years, can cause these things to start heading in the direction of Earth.
Okay, but considering how much stuff is out there, it seems that we very rarely get meteorites. But actually, I wanted to know, do we know how many meteorites hit and land on Earth in a day? And why aren't there more?
Yeah, good question. It depends really what size you're talking about. Basically, like the bigger the rock that we're talking about, then the more rare it is. So one of the things, just as a kind of a, you know, we estimate these things, right? Like it's quite hard to give very precise numbers. But just as a kind of a rough idea, if you were to be talking about a meteorite about the size of an olive, right? So you would get one of those per year for an area about the size of Wales, right? So that's the kind of thing we're talking about. If we're talking about much larger rocks, then they're much, much rarer, of course, and that's a good thing because they can be kind of dangerous. On the other hand, one of the things I write about in my book is what we call micrometeorites. So this is, you know, crudely speaking, you could call it sort of stardust or space dust. And with that, we think we're getting about 6 tons of it every day. So that's obviously, yeah. So when we get down to the really small stuff, we're talking about a lot of material.
And do we detect that or do we see that anywhere?
So, yeah, I mean, I can tell you, this is one of the things that I found really fascinating when I was writing my book, The Meteorite Hunters. And it's something I write about in a lot of depth, these micrometeorites. And it is very difficult to find it, but I met a guy called John Larsen, who is he's an interesting character. He is actually Norway's most famous jazz guitarist, if you believe that. He is the unlikely hero who has been revolutionizing the hunt for these micrometeorites. So I went to meet him, and yes, so there are ways of getting hold of it, but it's certainly not easy.
So what is the use of finding and exploring what's in these meteorites? What can they tell us of interest that we don't already know about the formation of our solar system?
Yeah, so this is one of the things that has sort of started me off on the quest to write my book, because I was at this conference years ago, like a scientific conference, and they were talking about meteorites as being these kind of time capsules from the birth of the solar system and how we could sort of use them to understand the history of the solar system. And I wanted to know, what do we learn from them? And I guess maybe I can tell you a bit of a story about how meteorites have sort of changed a little bit and added evidence to a sort of a different way of thinking about the history of the solar system. So to start off with, what I need to tell you is just like picture in your mind the solar system as we know it today. So you've got these four rocky planets. You've obviously got Mercury, Venus, Earth, and Mars. And then after that, you've got these much larger gassy planets, Jupiter, Saturn, Neptune, Uranus. And if you think about it, it's quite a sort of neat and tidy arrangement for a planetary system, right? You've got the four smaller ones, you've got the four gassy larger ones. So the question that astronomers have had for, you know, decades is that a normal and natural way for a solar system to be arranged? And in a way, the assumption was always that it very much was, because if you think about it, the way that the solar system would have formed, you would have had the sun, and you would have had this disk of gas and dust surrounding it, swirling around. And the planets would have ultimately formed from that disk of dust and gas. And of course, there would have been a temperature gradient across it. So you would have had the kind of the more rocky materials closer to the hot sun and the cold, the sort of the gassy stuff, the condensing further out. So in a way, it seems natural that a solar system would be organized like that. However, in the 90s, we started to be able to look out at other planetary systems, and we started to see that they're not like that at all. Many of them, anyway. We see these things that are known as hot Jupiters. So we're talking about these gas giant planets that are really close to their stars. And we, as far as we know, there's no way that these exoplanets, hot Jupiters, could have formed in such close proximity to their star. And that led to this really key idea in planetary science, which kind of came about, we're talking 20 years ago, and it's the idea of planetary migrations. It's the idea that given that these hot Jupiters around other stars couldn't have formed where we see them now, logically speaking, they must have moved. So the question became, have the planets in our own solar system moved around and migrated? And it's this that meteorites are starting to give us some really key evidence on, because we sort of naturally thought that, like, just to cut to the chase, there are these two models that appeared sort of 20 years ago. One is called the Nice model. It's named after the French city where it was developed. And basically it says that Jupiter and some of the other planets would have moved around.
Moved around in what way?
So there are slightly different ideas, like people have different, slightly different ideas about this. But so Jupiter might, for example, have formed more or less where it is now, and then it might have moved inwards almost to kind of where Mars is, and then kind of gone back to where it is now. And one of the reasons why this makes sense is because Mars, people might not necessarily think about this much, but Mars is actually a very small planet. It's only about a tenth of the mass of Earth.
Mm.
And that's quite a difficult thing to explain. But when you start to say, well, maybe Jupiter moved in and stole some of its material, it's kind of an appealing model.
Wow.
If that makes sense.
Yeah.
You might be thinking, this is all just to sort of set up, you know, how astronomers have been thinking over the past few decades. They've been starting to think that these planetary migrations might have happened. But the trouble is, very difficult to prove, of course, yeah. Because, you know, how would we do it?
And meteorites aren't from Jupiter or Mars. They wouldn't have those rock or material from either planet, would they necessarily?
Absolutely. You've got it, Jonathan. So they're not, it's not that they give us material that comes from Jupiter. However, what I've discovered, what they can do is they can kind of, they can act as kind of tracers that show the gravitational sort of instability in the solar system. So there's this thing called, it's a scientific idea, it's called the Great Dichotomy. And what we discovered, basically, in this idea, came about around sort of 10 years ago, is that all meteorites, if you look at something called their isotopes, which is basically like slightly different versions of the atoms that make them up, according to these isotopic patterns, you can work out that all meteorites came from these two distinct groups that must have been kind of kept separate.
Or like a sort of a genealogy of meteorites.
Exactly, yeah. So it's like a genealogy. There were these two separate spatial regions where they formed. And it makes sense that something like Jupiter, because it's so big and has such a gravitational influence over the solar system, it was probably Jupiter that kept these two things apart.
Right.
But if you think back to what we were talking about at the beginning of the conversation, what we now know is that all these asteroids, which is where meteorites come from, they're now jostling all together in this asteroid belt between Jupiter and Mars. So if you follow the logic of that story, what it means is that originally all these asteroids, which is where meteorites come from, were two separate things. And now something big, something gravitational, must have prompted them to all fly around in the solar system and get mixed up and meet in the middle.
Right.
And basically that gives us, I know that's a bit of a convoluted story, but it gives us this hard evidence that something huge, namely Jupiter, probably moved around, and it's lending support for this alternative history of the solar system.
Yeah, 10 years is very early for definitive proof of anything, I find, in astronomy. It seems like you'll find someone's coming up with a very, very different theory in no time. But really interesting to think about that. I never heard that theory that Jupiter moved closer to the sun and then back out again in its orbit. What about these meteorites? Like, are they worth anything? If something were to land on me, and I presume it's just complete randomness where they land, but if something were to land, or is it? Would the angle of the Earth affect the likelihood of getting a meteorite?
Oh gosh, that's a tricky question. The answer to that is that...
I love those.
Yeah, we think that it does, because obviously, like...
You have more atmosphere to fly through.
Yeah, it's a bit like if you imagine you're driving along in your car and it's like raining or something. You've got a slightly higher chance of the rain sort of hitting your windscreen rather than the top of the car, if you see what I mean. So there is slight differences about where meteorites land in terms of the latitude.
Right. So if one were to land in my back garden, what would it be worth anything? If I had a big one, could I sell it?
Yeah, you definitely could. And there are meteorite hunters, as the title of my book refers to, who make a living from this. They will have their backpacks ready to go. And as soon as they hear news of a meteorite fall, they will jump on a plane and go.
Really?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, there are people that do this. They make a good living out of it. There's a guy named Michael Farmer, for example. Made a lot of money from this kind of thing.
When you say a lot of money, like, am I going to be able to retire early, or am I just going to be able to pay the bills?
Yeah, it depends. Depends on the meteorite. So there are the most common type of meteorite is just called an ordinary chondrite, and that is, I'm sorry to tell you that if you do get one of these landing in your back garden, it's almost certainly going to be one of those, because that is about 95% of all meteorites.
Right.
And you could still make some money from that, but it's not going to kind of maybe you're not going to retire.
Change your life. It's not generational wealth, as they say on these social media
things. don't give up the day job.
But there's another type of meteor that is very valuable. What is that and how much is it?
So there's all sorts of different types out there. So things like, for example, the pallasites. So these are meteorites that are a mixture of metal and minerals, and if you cut them open, it almost looks like, in the book I talk about it looking a bit like an alien stained glass window. So they are kind of beautiful objects, and obviously they, for that reason, they collect a lot of they fetch a lot of money among collectors. So if you get a pallasite, for example, you're going to be in the money. The other options are going to be things like from the Mars or from the moon. If you get something like that, that's also going to be worth a lot of money.
Okay. Oh, and like, what is the most one has ever sold for?
I heard of one that sold for about £43,000 quite recently. So that's quite a lot.
Okay. Price of airfare these days, and then you've got expenses. I don't know. It seems like a risky endeavor. Really interesting. You can read the stories of some of these mad meteor hunters that Josh met in the book. It's called The Meteorite Hunters. Josh, how'd you go? Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Future Proof Extra
with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland
on News Talk.
Psoriatic arthritis symptoms can be unpredictable.
I had joint pain and I couldn't move like I used to.
I needed relief.
I got Cosentyx.
It helped me move better.
Cosentyx secukinumab is prescribed for people 2 years of age and older with active psoriatic arthritis. Don't use if you're allergic to Cosentyx. Before starting, get checked for tuberculosis. An increased risk of infections and lowered ability to fight them may occur, like tuberculosis or other serious bacterial, fungal, or viral infections. Some are fatal. Tell your doctor if you have an infection or symptoms like fevers, sweats, chills, muscle aches, or cough, had a vaccine or plan to, or if inflammatory bowel disease symptoms develop or worsen. Serious allergic reactions and severe eczema-like skin reactions may occur. Learn more at 1-844-COSENTYX or Cosentyx.com.
Ask your rheumatologist about Cosentyx.